I think about this idea of taking the life and times of Christ and trying to make some sense of it in such a short period of time, the more ridiculous it is. I have been learning about Christ for X number of years, as you have been. And what I'm astounded by is the fact that there is a continuum of learning, which is appropriate since Peter said that's what we should do. Grow in grace and knowledge. And in so doing, I hope that we can affect some of that today. So just a reminder, refresh you, some of you may not have been here yesterday. The subtitle to what we're talking about is Jews, Gentiles, Guni. I put the accent, the long E accent on to show you how it should be pronounced. Guni. And Jesus. Now, Guni, for those who were not here, is the Greek word for women or woman. Now, unfortunately, well, yesterday we tried to cover some of these two, but today we're going to talk about the Guni, the women. Now, in our English usage, unfortunately, comedians do this, and people, men, when they're angry, do this. They say, woman! And you know, that is not an endearing expression in the context and in our English usage. But when it's said in a quite a soft way, really, guni in Greek, if we spoke Greek, that does not have a harsh sound to it. It really doesn't. Guni. Now, women or woman, as Christ used the expression, he used it once, oh, several times, really, but he used it twice to his mother. Once at Cana, when he turned the water to wine, woman, what have I to do with you concerning this, which is an awkward English translation of that Greek. And then again, when he was hanging on the tree, he turned to John and says, you know, John, behold your mother, woman, behold your son. But it was a saying of respect, not ridicule. If you'll turn with me to Matthew 5:28, Christ, in the midst of his teaching on the Mount, addresses several things, but one of the things he addresses is this thing of adultery. And if we will read verse 28, we will find him introducing us to something or substantiating something in our minds that we should fully consider. When we commonly think of adultery, we think of men being the adulterer, but there always has to be a partner. But in this context, he says in verse 28, but I say unto you, that whosoever looks on a woman, so he's identifying men in particular, looks upon a woman to lust after her, has committed adultery with her already in his heart. What is he saying here? Many things, but for our emphasis today, he's saying that a woman is not a vessel of dishonor and disrespect. That's not what she is. She is not a sex object to be lusted after. Is that not the case? For whoever does it disrespects the woman. Now, in Christ saying this, he gives insight into his view of women. He recognized the societal boundaries that said a woman was essentially like chattel, no rights, insignificant, someone who could never be on a par with a man. And that was a continuing point of view, both before Christ and after Christ. Is it not so today? It's no wonder then that women would be in rebellion at some time concerning that status or that view. Now, it should not be so in the church, but unfortunately, the truth is, it is so. Which then fuels this thing or this argument or this desire on the part of some women to be more significant in the church because they see their role as never being able to ascend to the lofty level of standing in a pulpit and addressing a crowd, as if that is a big deal. So I'm not talking today then about whether women can preach. That's not the discussion. We have a tradition established on the basis of what Paul wrote, and according to the tradition of the eldership of Israel, we follow the principle. But in following that principle, ladies, and I'm trying to give voice to you today, because you can't stand here, I'm going to try to give voice for you and try to give a perspective on what we all should have concerning nearly 50% or over 50% of the population, and if the truth were known when we talk about church, more than 50% of your presence. So Christ then says a woman is not to be disrespected. She should not be the object of ogling and, you know, demeaning types of comments and an idea that, well, all she's good to be good for is to be kept barefoot and pregnant. The jokes go, you know. Christ had a lot of dealings with women, significant dealings with them. Let's look at some of them today to get a greater insight into how he operated. Matthew 9, there are parallel scriptures. One in Mark is in Mark 5, and the one in Luke is in Luke 8. But we'll take a look at the Matthew account. Matthew 9, and we'll start in verse 20. What it was that Christ took opportunity to do, and we looked at one example yesterday regarding a Gentile, regarding the Roman centurion. And Christ made the statement, I haven't seen faith like what this centurion has. And he turned around and said it to the Jews following him. Now, he made the same statement about some Jews who had the same kind of faith. Jairus comes to mind as an example of a Jew who was a leader in the synagogue and had a great amount of faith to go when his daughter died to talk to Christ about the situation. So there was faith in among the Jews, definitely among the Gentiles, but now let's look at this woman and see her faith. And we know the story of the woman with the hemorrhage, the issue of blood for 12 years. There was another woman mentioned in another account, I think it was 18 years. She had had an infirmity of some kind, but this woman for 12 years had had this infirmity. And the marvelous thing about this example, I won't read it word for word, is that she took a chance to get out into public. I gave a sermon not too long ago about the touch that makes whole, that makes you whole, because it was against the law for her in her condition to be out and about, as the Old Testament law said. If you were in this hemorrhage condition, you were unclean for X number of days, and so many days thereafter. So she took a chance. She, in fact, put into action her faith. And I find that proclivity pronounced among women, don't you? They will take action because they are told, we are told by the society around us and the psychologists, that women are emotional centered. And they say that, of course, as a negative. You know, women are just so emotional. Well, that may be true, and it could be as a negative. But I think when we examine the content of the New Testament and see women in action, yes, they were moved by emotion. Yes, they expressed themselves in ways while men were off having meetings. You know, men love to meet and discuss and harangue, and women are out doing. Is that not the case? Let's be honest and within ourselves that is so. Still, we're not talking about women preaching. See, we're not talking about that. But hopefully before we finish what we're talking about, we will see the role of women in a way and a significance that we never saw before. So this woman had this great faith. She had spent all of her money, gone to all of the doctors, those men who know everything, And they extracted from her all that she had, and still she was not healed. So she determined within herself that she would go and find this Jesus. For she said, if I could just touch the edge of his garment, I know that I will be made whole. And that is exactly what she did. And Christ dealing with her in the midst of this crowd around. Here was an opportunity to put this woman in her place. Was it not? But her place was exalted. Well, let's see if we can find the words here. Verse 21, for she said within herself, if I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. But Jesus turned about, and when he saw her, he said, daughter, daughter, be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole, and the woman was made whole from that hour. And when Jesus came into the ruler's, he's following along now with Jairus to heal the lady. Let's turn over to Luke's account, Luke 8, to continue the story, because Luke puts it in more detail for us. Luke 8 and verse 43. She had to sneak through the crowd, and you know when you were in a condition of uncleanness, you were supposed to warn the people in the public that that was the case. If you were a leper, you know, you had to say, leper approaching, leper, and holler it out. And of course, people, if they saw you, would say the same thing. So you were an outcast. She came from behind him in verse 44 and touched the border of the garment, and immediately her issue of blood staunched, or it stopped. Jesus asked, well, who touched me? For he knew that in this touch, in this emotionally centered woman, was a significant touch, not merely the jostling of a crowd. His disciples responded, what do you mean, who touched you? Because in a crowd like this, anybody could have touched you. The vision of the male. It's right about here most of the time, you know, right at the edge, right here. That's why, men, we have this difficulty with women, because you see, when you have plans for the future and you don't think you need to add any detail to it, and they are detail-oriented, they want to know, well, now, how is that going to happen? And you just say, well, it's going to happen. You know, I have it all right here. But the woman, she needs to know a little bit more than that, you see. And so the battle goes on between us, because we don't want to acknowledge that difference. And if we acknowledge, we can do something about it. Anyhow, when everybody denied him, Peter wondered, what are you talking about in this throng? Anybody could have touched you. Jesus said, somebody has touched me, for I perceive that virtue has gone out of me, power has gone out of me. When the woman saw that she was not hid, that she couldn't get away with it, she came trembling and fell down before him. Trembling, emotionally centered, fell down at his feet, declared unto him before all the people for what cause she had touched him, and how she was healed immediately. He said to her, daughter, be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole. An example of faith in action. Not waiting for something to happen, she went out and made it happen. That's an example for male and female alike. There's another example of Christ dealing with a woman. In the midst, now, understand, his dealings came in the midst of crowds many times, and his conversations with them and the treatment of the woman was different than the way it was in his time. Really different. Let's look in Matthew 15. This is probably my favorite account of this event. You find it also in other accounts. I didn't write it down, but Matthew 15, let's look at this woman. Now, I told you yesterday that we would get to the issue about women, but we're going to find that there's a combination of the Gentile and the Guni, or the woman, in this situation, in this account. For this woman was not a Jewess. Is not Jewish. We'll start in, verse 22 or 21. Then Jesus went thence and departed into the coast of Tyre and Sidon. That's If you are at Capernaum, Capernaum is on the north side, northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. And Tyre and Sidon is on the coast if you head due northwest. And so he traveled away from the Sea of Galilee. I mean, because all these people are around in Capernaum, and they're really wanting something from him. So he travels away, and he goes up to the coast or the borders of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came out of the same coast. In one account, she's called the Syrophoenician woman, describing the area. Phoenicia was on the coast. Syria, of course, was inland, but in that region is what it was talking about. Now, in describing her from the land of Canaan, he does not necessarily describe her racially, but he establishes where she's from, and therefore you can't conclude that she was a Jew, that she was from a different region, for his response is instructive. She came out of the coast and cried unto him, saying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, you son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil." Now, she had heard about Christ. She knew that he had been born in the city of David, Bethlehem. That's why she called him a son of David. Now, whether she knew he was more than that, we don't know. But look at her response. First, verse 23, he answered her not a word. Now, if you are emotionally centered, or even if you are hard-hearted and stiff-necked and got a chip on your shoulder, usually if somebody doesn't answer you, you go away. We take the attitude, that's the way it is, then I will do my own thing. You don't answer me, I'm leaving. But she didn't do that. And what she's going to display for us is a woman of great faith despite the response. He doesn't answer her. Right? Verse 23 continuing, and his disciples came and besought him, saying, "Send her away. Get rid of her, for she cries after us." Oh, us? I thought she said son of David. But sometimes we like to associate ourselves with the power brokers. You see, and Christ to them was a power broker, so it's us now. She's bothering us. I mean, our time together, Lord. You know, we might want to go fishing, we might want to do something else, but she's bothering us. So then Jesus answered in verse 24, "I am not sent but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Now, we could talk a long time about that, because he didn't say the house of Judah, which would have limited right to that area of Judea where the Jews essentially were, except those in the dispersion in the diaspora. But he says the house of Israel. Now, I have an opinion, but it's based on what I've done studying about this thing of Israel. Bear with me a moment. You see, there was a physical house of Israel long since gone into captivity somewhere. And there was the house of Judah, and essentially by the time Christ walked the earth, this was a compilation of a lot of different kinds of people. But when I examine what the word Israel means, it opens up a panoply of possibilities that includes Jews, Gentiles, and Guni. For Israel, in its strictest meaning, means one who rules as God. That's what it means. There are any number of people who can qualify for that, to be in that house. And essentially, God, the Christ, was going to open the house up anyhow, where there would be these places of abode in that mansion that he talked about. I suspect that some of you are saying, "Yeah, but I don't think that is the case." No, it is the case. That's why we have Paul talking about a wild olive branch grafted into a tree. That's why he talks about those things. That's why there was a vision by Peter to go to Joppa to talk to Cornelius. That's why there was such an uproar in the first century church, because all decorum was being ignored. And these people are being added to us who were not part of us before, and on top of it, we are talking about them not having to be circumcised? What do you mean? How can that be? "I am sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel? Was this the past house or future house? Think about it. Consider how expansive was to be this house, how open the door was, for Christ says, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me." Those were the invitations he issued. And he issued them to a lot of people. And unfortunately, only a few responded. Most outstanding in the response are the Guni, as we shall see. Well, he says, I'm not sent to this broad this broad group of people, you see. I'm only sent to this narrow group of people, right? But her response is, in verse 25, she came and worshipped him even more, saying, "Lord, help me." You see, there was a determination within her to be in the house. She wasn't going to be shut out of the house. She was going to knock on the door, and as Bum Phillips said with the Houston Oilers, I can't quote it exactly, but we got up to the door, we knocked on the door, and the next time we're going to knock it down, is essentially what he said, but he had a little more of an expression that would be inappropriate to use here. We knocked on the door, now we're going to knock the door down. Well, she was going to knock the door down. Then he said something startling. He answered and said, "It is not suitable or meet to take the children's bread." What children are we talking about now? Are we talking about the Jews? Well, by analogy, that's what he's saying. Take the Jews' bread, or the house of Israel's bread, in a limited perspective that the Israelites had, or the Jews had, as we talked about yesterday. A very narrow view. The king of the Jews. Getting rid of the Roman domination. That's all they thought about. It's not suitable to take the children's bread and cast it to dogs. Whoa. Now, if you are emotionally centered, and if you are sensitive to being insulted, and you've got a chip on your shoulder, this is where you get up and walk away. It's tantamount to being called the N-word. Uh-huh. The scriptures talk a lot about dogs. You can take your concordance and look it up, and you'll find that this expression is used in regarding people of loose morals. People who are not in control of themselves. They're dog-like, having no boundaries or no limitations as to what they will do. So he says to her, "It is not suitable for the children's bread to be ingested by people with loose morals or dog-like qualities." You know? Now, we've tried to water that down to say, well, no, he wasn't insulting her. No, I don't think he was insulting her purposely, but he was trying to find out something in the midst of observers. He didn't do this off in a corner. He was being watched on how he's going to deal with this woman, this Gentile woman at that. Her response, and I love this, you see, sometimes you've got to, if you want a yes from God, you've got to say yes. If you want a yes, where is your yes? So she says, "Truth, Lord." Verse 27, "Yet the dogs eat of the crumbs which fall from their master's table." I'll take that position. You say I'm a dog. You say that the children sit at the table and I just have to lick up the crumbs. That's the truth. I'll take the crumbs. I'll take the crumbs, for in the crumbs I can fabricate enough to live off of. Christ's response in verse 28. "O Guni, O woman, great is your faith." And that's all that Christ wants from us. That kind of faith. The kind of faith that fights through the crowd like the woman with the issue of blood. The kind of faith that even when you are embarrassed and ridiculed and it's seemingly put down, you rise above it. And I understand why women have that thing, and I understand the women's liberation thing, and I understand the women's suffrage deal, because you understand this nation and the document sitting up in Washington. called the Constitution. When it was written, they had to determine how we're going to divvy up the money and how we're going to count people. Now, the slaves were equated as being 5/8 a person. Each slave was 5/8. We're talking about voting, you know, rights and that kind of thing. But you know what women were? The same. 5/8. Because women didn't get the right to vote in this country until you know when, in this century. They were in the same category when you add it up as a slave in this nation, the United States of America. 5/8. There were a number of Indians as well. A lot of people fit into that category. Only property-owning Anglo-Saxon Protestant white guys, you know, in the club had the vote. You follow what I'm saying? Trying to relate it then to what conditions these women were living under. And for Christ to take the time with these women who came to him and explain things to them and share things with them was like, is he crazy? Has he lost it? Because this is not the way we do things around here, boy. You know what I mean? Okay, so you're following me. I think you're with me on this now. Okay. This is an illustration, then, of perseverance by this woman. Perseverance. And any person can take that example. Any man, any woman can persevere. Can persevere even when things don't seem to be like you want them to be. They're not ideal. I know so many people in coming contact with the church, the Worldwide Church of God as it was then, on the area of race in particular, were confronted with some things. I mean, those articles and things that came out in the Plain Truth in 1957, 58, 59 on race stuff, and especially in 63, 64, 65. I got to tell you, they were really bad. They were really bad. And the kinds of greeting I got the first Sabbath at the headquarters church in Pasadena was not, hello, glad to see you, welcome to the church. Don't you know the Negroes meet in Los Angeles? By one of the superdeacons, you know. That's the way it was. Mr. Justice, my dad, is here, and I worked for him in the press, and he took me out on that Sunday. That was the Sabbath and Sunday. He took me around showing me the city of Pasadena. I'll never forget it because he took time beyond just saying, hey, don't you know this? Don't you know the way we do things around here, boy? I mean, you know, he didn't do that. So we've had a connection ever since, for he acted responsibly, and that's the way we should be. But that's probably an aside that is only interesting to me, maybe. Now let's turn over to another example of Christ dealing with women, Mary and Martha, Luke 10. It's so remarkable in his dealings with these women. Now, we know for a fact that he was very close to Mary and Martha. We know that at the request of Christ, at the time that their brother Lazarus died, he came. Delayed his coming, but he did come. There was obviously a special relationship with these women. Very special. Let's see, I have it in Luke 10, beginning in verse 38. Now it came to pass as they went, he and the disciples, that they entered into a certain village. We know that was Bethany from another account, I think in John. And a certain woman named Martha received him into her house. She was hospitable. Now, we all value someone who has that quality. Hospitable. Anyone can have it, male or female. But there seems to be a proclivity on the part of women to have that. They have the innate desire to serve in this way, to be hospitable. Come on over. Let's have coffee. Let's have some of this. Let's have some of that. In fact, I think most men would say, people coming over when? Oh, no. I had planned to walk around in my shorts today. Yeah. You know how that is, fellas. Well, women will entertain. They will want to have him over. So he meets this woman, Martha. She invites him to her house. and she had a sister called Mary, which also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his voice. Now, contrast these two women. Martha is intense. Come on over to the house and I can serve you. You know, I can do some things, I can be busy serving. Now, Mary, her approach was more intellectual. She wanted to hear what he had to say, because he may not pass this way again. So she sits down at his feet and listening to his every word. And Martha is busy, cumbered about, it says, with much serving. And if you want to kind of take a look at this example of how jealousy can come along and creep up like a green-eyed monster, here it is. She's busy working, Martha. I mean, just sweating away. She comes and she sees her sister sitting, chilling out, you know, cooling it out with the master, listening to what he has to say. Now, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her to get up and help me serve, and, you know, that way she doesn't get any more than I get. Now, that's a human quality, male or female. But the fact is, Christ is spending time with these two women. And here is something he tells Martha at this point. Verse 41, Jesus answered and said unto her, Martha, and when he repeats something, that means pay attention. Martha, you are careful and troubled about many things. And we all are like that. But he says now, but one thing is needful. There's one thing that should have the primacy, shall we say, in a situation where you come in contact with Jesus. And the primacy is, Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. What a marvelous example Mary sets here. She may have been one of the Marys who stood at the foot of the cross, or in the proximity, we don't know, but because Mary was such a common name, but there she is. And Martha gets to learn from Mary in this context. Now, I want to look at one other example here. There were two accounts of a woman anointing Christ's body. There was one in Matthew 26 just prior to his crucifixion. I think that's the one I want to look at. Matthew 26. And verse 7. For women, like I say, they're action oriented, it seems. I mean, they will do things. You fellows probably know that every now and then your wife or may get the desire to clean the house up, and I tell you, and it's time to get out of the way. You know, make no questions about it. It's time to get this done. Move out of the way. Move whatever heavy has to be moved. No question about, well, why are you doing it? No, nope. Just get out of the way. It's time to do it. Okay? Well, that's the way that kind of thing happens. So here we find an action taken by this woman, Matthew 27, Matthew 26 and verse 7. Okay. Jesus was in Bethany again, to the house of Simon the leper. There came unto him a woman having an alabaster box of very precious ointment, and poured it on his head as he sat eating. And when the disciples saw it, they had indignation, saying, to what purpose is this waste? Didn't they know who Jesus was? Didn't they think this was a kind act? Didn't they think this was special? No. For this ointment, and you can hear the voice of Judas Iscariot here, for this ointment might have been sold for so much and given to the poor. And Jesus understood it. He conceived what was going through their minds. And he said unto them, why trouble you the woman? For she has wrought a good work upon me. For you have the poor always with you, but me you have not always. For in that she has poured this ointment on my body, she did it for my burial. Truly I say unto you, whosoever the gospel shall be preached, wherever the gospel shall be preached in the whole world, there shall also this saying go, that this woman has done. Behold, for a memorial of her. This example is going to be out there for all time, he says, of a woman who didn't sit around calculating, oh, if I spend that much on that thing, that's just probably a little too much, and that's a little too extravagant, and I probably shouldn't do that, and whether the fellows are going to think, she just did it. castigated by the men, in particular, Judas Iscariot. At this point, it was like the last straw. What does it say in verse 14? Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went out to the chief priest. That was the last straw. He took this expensive ointment and did this thing when it could have been done for something else. That's the last straw. I'm going to the chief priest. And he sold Christ out after the last straw by this woman, you see. Well, you look at some examples of Christ dealing with women and the respect he showed for them and the care and the tenderness that he showed for them. There is one outstanding example to look at. It's probably as important of one than we could ever find. Let's turn to the crucifixion time. Matthew 27, verse 55, we'll start with. I said that this is not about whether a woman can preach or teach. It's not about that. Or usurp authority over a man. This is not what this is about. For we have been influenced by this ongoing societal battle between men and women. And it should not be so among us, but we bring what we are from the outside and it infests us. And it influences us and it touches us. That's to be understood. But I'm here to tell you that this example we're going to see is so significant because it establishes that we are not limited by our sex as to what significant role we can play. For the significant role is not doing what I am doing or what other men do. This is, Paul called it foolishness of preaching. For if it did the kind of good that we hope for, there would be no need for me standing here. But there are some things that Christ shows by his dealings with women that can be done. Let's look. Matthew 27, verse 55. Christ has been buffeted about. It says in verse 54, now when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. And many women were beholding afar off, which followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering unto him. Serving is what it means. Where are the men? Hold up hiding for fear of the Jews. You mean the women weren't afraid of the Jews? If they were, it didn't deter them. These were women who had followed him, it says, where? From Galilee. Serving him. What were they doing? Were there clothes to be washed? Food to be cooked? Maybe somebody to listen, like Mary and Martha. Maybe somebody to pray. Because women seem to do that. They seem to find a time to pray. Remember the woman at the time of Christ's birth? Who had been praying, Anna, I think her name was, who stayed at the temple all those days waiting to see the Messiah. You remember her? I've known women who pray. They're kind of in a continual state of prayer. Friendly, warm, and generous. They could have the worst pain, the worst things in their lives, and they're constantly, you just ask them, would you pray for me? Yep, I'll do that. I have a friend. And I called her a friend, and she's more than a friend, up in the Cincinnati, Ohio area. A woman, she's 90 years old now, and she can't even get to the church building up there. Ollie Kittle, she's a praying lady. She's a woman that you can go to, as many in that area do, and ask that she join with them in prayer, because she will pray. And she has the curious thing of her prayers being answered. Except the one that she really longed for was that her husband of 60 years could have stayed with her, but he's dead now. And that troubles her yet, but she still prays. That's a proclivity that women have. So here are these women off to the side looking and observing. ministry, serving Christ in whatever way. They're by just in case they could be used or needed. Isn't that amazing? And the men are off meeting. Among them which were Mary Magdalene, you remember Mary Magdalene, the one who had the 7 demons cast out of her. She had special cause, and for whatever it's worth, the musical Jesus Christ Superstar with the poignant song that came out of it, I Don't Know How to Love Him. Remember that song? It was sung by Mary Magdalene for the purpose of saying, well, he's a man, but he's more than that, and I don't know how to judge my emotions, how to fully take him all in, because while I may be attracted to him as a man, I know he's more than that for what he did for me, yet I love him. And I don't know how to wrap it all up. That's a modern depiction of that particular account. Mary Magdalene was there, and then Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Could be Christ, it could be the Mary. She had 2 sons named James and Joseph, you know. The mother of Christ, maybe. And then mother of Zebedee's children, you know, James and John. And when the even was come, let's see if I want to continue. Well, verse 56, I got that one. So we establish who's there. Now, they're there. The men have run off while the women have kept watch, serving in some kind of way, words of encouragement, perhaps, an intent to return to the burial site later. Now, we also know that his mother was there, John 20. Let's turn to that. John 19, excuse me. Verse 25. We know she was there. Now, what I want to establish here in our thinking about these women being so close and so present there is that they have a testimony as poignant and as real as what the 12 had. They just didn't stand up in a pulpit or some place in the synagogue and tell about it. But is their story less significant if they tell about it at their house? I mean, does it lose some impact because they are not pontificating from a raised platform? Mary, Magdalene, tell us again what it was like when you were standing off in the distance and the Savior was dying. Tell us about that, because the disciples surely can't tell us because they weren't there. They only heard about it from who? The ladies. You see? You see what we're talking about here? Boy, this is deep. Okay, let's go on. Mary, the mother of Christ, was there, verse 25. Now there stood by the stake, the cross of Jesus, his mother, and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, in other places called Alphaeus, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by, the only one, John writes this in gratuitously because he's writing the book, the account. He says he was standing by, and Christ confirms it because he says, all right, the disciple standing by whom he loved, John, he says unto his mother, woman, there it is, behold your son. Then said he to the disciples, behold your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her into his own home. Beautiful. That Mary was taken care of by this disciple whom Christ loved. It was appropriate that be the case. She was there. What was her testimony like? From the time Gabriel showed up on the scene and said, blessed are thou among women. Did he not? For you see, women can do something that men can't. Women say we can do anything that a man can do. Well, except one. See, there's one thing that neither of us can do. We can't father a child if we are men, if we are women. And we can't mother a child if we are men. Isn't that something? And the appreciation of that difference is what elevates us into unity, to accept that fact. Despite what's going on out there in the world with the fighting between male and female, it should not be so among us. There should be appreciation of that distinction. For Mary had a testimony when Gabriel came and when she went to see Elizabeth, and she said the same words. And there was a time in the crowd, I made a note of it here someplace, I want to give it to you. It's a most interesting statement that was made by a woman in a crowd. I know I wrote it down, and I thought I had made note of it to tell you about it, but you can look it up later. My eye doesn't fall on my notes. In the midst of a crowd, this woman yells out, "Blessed is the woman who gave you the womb that gave you birth, and the paps that gave you suck." In other words, your mother is a great lady. Well, no question about it, but here's Christ's response. No, better are they who believe in the gospel. You remember the time when his family was standing outside and the message came in, your mother and your brothers and sisters outside? He says, no, these are my mother and brothers and sisters. In other words, there's something that transcends our physical endowments that connect us beyond bloodline in the sense of the physical. And Christ took every opportunity to point that out. Not demeaning the fact that his mother was significant, because his mother had this proclivity. It's a Greek word, theotokos. Theotokos, that's what Mary was. It means God-bearer. God-bearer. Theotokos. But you know, every mother is a potential God-bearer. If our potential is to be in the family of God, every woman is a Theotokos. God-bearer. That is really significant. Can't you see then, you can't find an example in the Gospels of Christ ever yelling at a woman, demeaning a woman to the extent that was common in his day. You can't find one. Even the woman taken in adultery. He didn't look at her and say, "Ha, got caught, didn't you?" No, he recognized the circumstances and he treated her with such gentleness and such care. That's why the expression woman, guni, is far more significant in its respect and its dignity for the woman. Christ recognized that it was necessary then, and it's necessary now in the times in which we live. Let's go now to Matthew 28, after the resurrection. Or the ladies didn't know. They had intended, as they stood by watching, that they were going to get over there. Well, you know what? I think maybe Luke's account is better. Luke 24. I'm sorry that you flipped over there, but turn to Luke 24, because Matthew is a kind of an incomplete account, but Luke has a little bit more going for us. Luke 24, beginning in verse 1. Now, upon the first day of the week, we know the whole story about that. Very early in the morning, the women, came to the sepulchre, bringing the spices which they had prepared and certain others with them. It was a gathering of women. Mary Magdalene was included. They found the stone had been rolled away from the sepulchre, and they entered in and found not the body of the Lord Jesus. And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments, angels. And as they were afraid and bowed down their faces to the earth, they said unto them, the angels did, "Why are you seeking the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spoke unto you when he was yet in Galilee." These were the same women had followed from Galilee that we'd read about, who were standing off in the distance watching this crucifixion, saying, "The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day shall rise again." And then they remembered his words, and returned from the sepulchre and told all these things unto the 11 and to all the rest. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and other women that were with them, which told these things unto the apostles. And here was the reaction. And their words seemed to them, these men, as idle tales, and they didn't believe it. Who were the messengers and the carriers of the good news that he is risen? Name the man. This is important because if we can have an appreciation of the kind of things that they didn't stand in the pulpit and preach it. They went and carried the message personally to the men who were chosen by Christ to carry it on further. But they didn't even believe it in the beginning. But the women told it anyhow. They told the story. I can't help but think about Mary Magdalene when she had reached some age and somebody knew that she was dwelling in a certain location would come to her and say, Mary, could you tell that story again? What was it like in the garden tomb? Tell us about that again. What, describe the angels again. What were they wearing? And the man you thought was the gardener in the tomb area, what was it like when you finally realized that it was the Savior? Tell us that story, Mary. You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying about personal testimony? How you could sit down with just a few people in a gathering and have as much impact or greater than anybody standing on a podium. You understand? What I'm trying to convey to you, ladies, and to us men as well, is that desiring and lusting after standing in a place where people can look at you like you're looking at me now and see all of your imperfections, which hair is out of place, whether the tie matches, you know, whether you chose the right words. But when a personal relationship exists where you can give your testimony face to face with inquiring minds who want to know, think about it. Think about how much more important that is. And Christ used women to convey that message. And I hope we buy it. I hope we ingest it. I hope we think about it. There's so much more we could talk about concerning this subject. It's probably been done inadequately to some degree. There was a woman at the well. What a story in John 4. She was a Gentile, a Samaritan at that. I hated this despised group of people by the Jews. He goes out there, he spends the time, you know the story about the woman at the well and discussion that went on with her, but the curious thing that is so significant there is that when the disciples came back and saw him talking to her, they were perplexed again. Why are you talking to this woman, let alone a Samaritan? But as a result of this woman's testimony, not preaching, not in teaching, the men of the town came out to see what she was talking about. Their response in John 4 is that, now, we believed you because of what you said, but we don't believe it because of what you said anymore. We believe it now because we have seen it ourselves. She caused them to respond by saying, this man has told me things about myself that never any man knew. And they wanted to see it. They wanted to experience it themselves. So they came out, and the whole town came out to see. As a result of this woman, Gentile, at a well, Christ told her things like, I have water to drink, that you will never thirst again. Think about it. That's how significant it is for each of our individual callings, male or female. It doesn't matter. Because in the realm in which you can work, see, every man is not qualified to stand up here either. You understand that? Just not. And if the truth were known, those of us who have the certificate question whether we are qualified to. But a job has to be done. We're called to do it, and we do it. But it's not to be desired and to be lusted after. For the testimony you can bring from your personal experience, one-to-one, one-to-two, in family gatherings, in fellowship together, inviting those in who are not part of the faith, is far more significant. Christ used the women to tell us about that. time to really break. Larry, we started late, so I just took a little extra time. I would ask you to do one thing as we break. If you would read Mark 7, the account dealing with the washing of hands and that which defiles and so forth and so on, to wrap up what we've talked about the Jews, the Gentiles, the Guni, and Jesus. Jesus puts it in perspective by saying, now, we're concerned many times about that which we see on the exterior, or that which we eat that sustain our lives. Didn't do away with the unclean meat issue at all, as many conclude that chapter to talk about. But what he does is establishes where the significant part of us is, that which comes out of us, that which motivates us, that which is internal within us, that which we give word to or expression to, that's what defiles. It was not cutting on the flesh by the Jews that made them significant. It was not the Gentiles because they seem more ready to respond. It was not the gender of the women that made them significant. But what was on the inside, that is the difference. For in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek or Gentile, male or female, slave or freeman. Is that what Paul wrote? And if that be true, all of us have access to the house of Israel.